You're listening to an American Theater podcast. American Theater is published by Theater Communications Group, www.americantheater.org.
Welcome to Off Script, American Theater's podcast on all things theatrical. I'm Rob Weiner, Kent, the editor-in-chief. I'm here with
Deep Tran, the associate editor,
and Allison Considine, the editorial assistant.
And we just got our December issue in, and I would like to talk about that. But first, I would like to be more formal about this and talk about what we're going to talk about, so you can toggle through this if you want to fast forward.
First, we're not going to do like the Maximum podcast where we give you like a time when everything shows up.
We can't do that, yeah. But we'll do like the Slate Gabfest where we say, here's what we're talking about. So first, we're going to talk about our new issue, a special issue with science fiction stories and a bunch of other things. Then we're going to talk about the latest casting controversy involving plays by Katori Hall and Lloyd Suh. And then we'll talk a little bit about the gala and the fall forum, which recently TCG hosted. It was a lot of fun. That will set up our interview this week, which is with Francine Reynolds, the artistic director of Mississippi's only Equity Theater, the New Stage Theater. She was in town for the TCG business, the fall forum.
Board meeting.
The board meeting, but also the gala and everything. And so she's on our board, and we decided to sit down with her while we had her in town. Then we'll close out with recommendations. Before we start, we have a little business to take care of. Deep?
Yes, we got our first ever notice about correction on this podcast, which when you're speaking about things off the cuff, it's really difficult to make sure that you're factually accurate because you don't have a fact checker. We should probably think
Let's
about
it. Let's hire one for our podcast.
But in the interview I did with Susan Booth a few episodes ago, I mentioned that the Alliance Theater, which Susan Booth is the artistic director of, that their upcoming production of Tuck Everlasting, which is transferring to Broadway, it's their first transfer, which is actually not true. It is their ninth transfer, and the other ones included Aida, The Color Purple, Sister Act the Musical, and Bring It On. So my apologies about that, everyone at the Alliance, and please continue listening to this podcast.
We will correct anything that you hear that's wrong. Hopefully there's nothing in our December issue to correct. It just came in, and we're super happy about it. Our theme for this issue, at least for a number of the stories, was science fiction / fantasy / speculative fiction, whatever fancy word you want to give to it. We've noticed what seems to be a trend of a lot of playwrights like Jennifer Haley, who has Deep wrote a big profile about, Mac Rogers here in New York. And then when I thought about it, I've seen him pretty much for my entire theater-going career. There have been plays you could call science fiction.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Like Alan Ackborn, Carol Churchill, Madeline George. Just like in the 70s, it's been a fruitful topic for many people.
Right. So in any case, we had fun with that. And I will also want to plug our cover story and a new feature we're trying out with American Theater called Production Notebook. We've done production notebooks before that were design focused, which we really were happy with, and beautiful photos and beautiful designs we've talked to designers about. The production notebook, actually, what we're trying to do is cover entire productions, basically from rehearsal to reviews is what I'm seeing, and the entire production process. So our first one, which gave us the idea for science fiction theme, was Capitol Stage in Sacramento's production of Anne Washburn's Mr. Burns, a post-electric play, which is one of the most produced plays in the coming season, in the current season, at TCG Theaters. And I thought it was a good opportunity to talk about a theater we haven't written about a lot, and also about a play that everyone's doing, about the challenges of it from a design, from a dramaturgical, from a casting, from music direction. It's a very challenging, ambitious, and fun piece. And it did challenge audiences too. The response was certainly ran the gamut. So we're going to be doing that in every issue. The next one I can tease right now, we're just working on a piece about Basil Twist's recent show at Abrams Art Center, Sisters Follies.
Yes, his newest puppet show. I dropped in on rehearsals and dress rehearsals and then talked to the creative team afterwards about it. And the fun fact about that was Basil was on stage at Abrams and he got a phone call, and it was the MacArthur Foundation telling him that he just won $625,000.
He was a genius.
He was a genius.
We know he's a genius, but
yes. Now it's been officialized.
Exactly. So look for those production notebooks. I can also tease, I don't think without any danger, we're doing one about Confederacy of Dunces, the new show at the Huntington, with Nick Offerman in that adaptation of the popular novel. So this is something you'll see roll out every month in American Theater. We're trying this out. In this December issue, we also published the complete script of Ruby Ray Spiegel's really moving play, Dry Land. Love that play.
Do you want to tell us what it's about?
Well, I don't want to be too much of a spoiler, but it is about young women and their bodies and about their relationship. There's sort of, I would say, I call it sort of a play about the limits of youthful friendship in a way, even though it's also about many other things. I mean, it's also about abortion, but that's not really a spoiler, I guess, because it's in the first scene, right?
Yeah, and we went back and forth on a particular photo with blood involved, but I don't think we actually got the photos because it said spoiler alert.
Yeah, it wasn't like the
Rajiv Joseph's Gazetaj
where blood was a major factor in the play. So that's in there. I'm also really proud of a piece that we ran. We've had long had an idea about by Celia Wren about theaters and work life balance, which is another word for theaters accommodating people with families, people with single people that have different needs. It's a complicated and interesting issue about sort of theaters internal, the way they work, the way they work with their staffs, their human resources issues. And it's sort of just the beginning of a conversation that a lot of theaters are, from Cleveland Playhouse to Center Stage. I remember Hana Sharif at the she works as associate artistic director at Center Stage. I was in a totally there was a sort of breakout session at the conference last June in Cleveland about that issue. We had a lot of great stuff we got from that, but it was a totally separate session. I was sitting, and Hana Sharif mentioned that her daughter has a desk. Her little 5-year-old daughter has a desk right next to her at her desk at Center Stage. So I thought that's a photo. B, that's like the if not the lead, that's in the story. So, and yeah, it is in there.
What I loved most about that story, well, one of the things I loved was there's this little tidbit about how these rooms for parents to, you know, go and breastfeed and just have some privacy. They're also open to staff who just, you know, sometimes you're overworked and you need to take a minute and just go play with some stuffed animals.
Or Mr. Potato Head.
And so I'm hoping we get one at TCG because sometimes it's hard to not throw things at each other.
Yeah. Yeah. What's interesting about the issue is, and I've been on panels actually over the years at different TCG conferences, is that when you start to talk about family policies, you start to talk about the conflicts that happen just naturally among workers, whether it's along gender lines, which is often happens between men and women, and the amount of leave that's offered to them, and also among people with families and single people, about the workload, about who gets special treatment or special benefits. So places like Cleveland Playhouse have tried to look at it in terms of wellness, overall wellness, so that it's really a welcoming place for people at any stage of their life or with any special needs, whether it's caring for an elderly parent, because that's another caregiving situation, or people who don't have those kind of responsibilities but have busy lives and probably, you know, or in some cases, especially young people, are sort of asked to do a lot more to fill in the gaps. And sometimes that's fine. Other times, it's not. So, and it's good for people to be able to take breaks and, you know, whether it's to take care of your kids or just to take care of yourself. So
where's our room full of stuffed animals?
We're working on that. We're working on that. So that's an exciting December issue. Should we switch over to, I think Deep, we should just give you a column now because this happened. This seems to be come so frequent that there's almost a weariness about it. Like, when are people going to get it? It is a slightly different situation because it's educational. But let explain what happened in the past 2 weeks at two different colleges.
Sure. Well, I'm sure many of you have read my previous column on the subject of casting an appropriation called Keep Your Hands Off of My Kimono, White People. And in the past month or so, there was a production of Katori Hall's The Mountaintop at Kent State University. The Mountaintop, for those of you who don't know, is a two-hander featuring Martin Luther King and a fictional maid on the night before his assassination. And the director of the Kent State production, he had casted a white actor to play Dr. King to play with the idea of, you know, a person should be judged by the content of the character, not by the color of their skin. Amazing sentiment, not really applicable for where we are in 2015. And similarly, Clarion University in Pennsylvania, they had gotten the rights to do another play called Jesus in India by playwright Lloyd Suh. They had gotten the permission to do it as a classroom exercise, as a musical, because it's written as a play. And then this is where it gets murky. They never got the permission to do the play as a production, but they went ahead and did it, and they casted white actors as Indian characters.
Right.
And Lloyd did not find that out until he saw on Facebook, and after which he pulled the rights from the play, which they never really had rights to begin with, and canceled their production. And so now it's become a conversation about universities and casting in universities. Mm-hmm. And when you don't have the student body, because Clarion University, their student body population is 80% white.
Oh, no, it's more than, way more than that, isn't it?
Way more than that, probably. Yeah, yeah. But it's like less than 3% Asian.
Yeah.
So there weren't enough actors to cast that play anyway. So if you're a student and you want to do this role in a university setting / production, is that okay? And if it isn't okay, then you're basically not exposing these students to works that might benefit them in thinking about the world in a different way and from the lens of a person of color.
Right.
The counter argument to that, which I presented in the piece that I wrote, which is called On Playwrights' Rights and White Tears. And this is what both Lloyd and Katori expressed in various op-eds and Facebook posts, was it's as a playwright, they are allowed to pull the rights from any plays that don't match with their vision. That's been something that's been done since time immemorial. We should not be having a problem with that.
Right.
But it's also on a moral level, when you're talking about this tradition, which for hundreds of years have limited opportunities for people of color and I'll say even further, just for women, to cast a white person in a role reserved for a person of color is upholding this very racist tradition.
Right, right.
And even in an educational context, having a white actor play a role reserved for an Indian actor or a black actor doesn't teach them anything about race relations. What does teach them about race relations is having them do it in a classroom and then having them talk about why in the real world this might not work because of XYZ racial history.
Right, right, right. Yeah, no, it seems like when you say roles reserved for actors of color, it wasn't in the script this is the argument, that they should have, and now of course Lloyd and Katori are both making clear that they can't be cast that way without their permission, but the South Asian actors have to be cast, in Lloyd's play, in the South Asian roles, and that Martin Luther King should be cast with an African American, which seems kind of self-evident. Allison, do you have anything to add to this? I know we haven't gone to you.
I don't know. I think it's something that I've been thinking about this week as all these topics have been coming up, is this idea of how casting differs in universities and classroom settings, as opposed to the professional world. But it is definitely a topic. I covered the August Wilson monologue competition. I know that's something we talked about earlier too, where they make August Wilson's, his cycle of work available to all students, all genders, and they make that available to them to participate in the monologue competition. And
right.
They see there's great importance in that. And I know Kenny Leon has talked about that, how the work should be accessible and the stories
all ethnicities too,
all
as well.
Ethnicities.
Yeah. I think the responsibility really falls to educators. I mean, in that case, they've made August Wilson's monologues available, and it's for a particular way to study them and approach them. you know, and I have heard educators say that in classroom settings, doing August Wilson's work with white students or people of all different backgrounds is actually can be really educational, as long as it's put in the context, not just of casting history, but just let's talk about what this play says about the African-American experience, right? But it's true. When you put up a public production, which student productions are public, right, and you get a license from the playwright, you're representing their work and you're representing the African-American experience to people who weren't part of that classroom discussion, who weren't part of the whole syllabus, and they're just watching it. And I think that that's where it makes sense to honor the playwright's vision, whether it's Samuel Beckett saying that for his own reasons, his estate saying that women can't play Waiting for Godot, which that's his right. A totally different side of the argument, but you know, Lloyd and Katori should have the right to say, oh, that's, I mean, one thing that was pointed out in Katori's editorial is that she has another play, The Children of Killers, which is about the genocide in Rwanda. And she's made clear that she doesn't insist on African or race-specific casting because her play is about tribalism and genocide, and it should be applicable in a literally universal way. That's not the case of, as she says, of a lot of her plays writing about specific experience, the specific African-American experience, you know, which has been not only historically underrepresented, but, you know, is a distinct experience which, you know, deserves to be seen.
Well, I didn't get to point this out in my op-ed, but I feel like whenever we're talking about these topics and then we point out various examples just to counter each other, and I always, these days, I'm trying to stress that just because one playwright of color says it's okay to do XYZ with their play doesn't mean it's applicable to all playwrights of, well, plays featuring actors of color.
Right.
I mean, characters of color.
Well, in either direction, there's some playwrights who think it's okay and others who think it's not okay, and it's also different plays of theirs,
exactly,
right? As we say
exactly.
In the case of Katori. So I think this is something that we've spoken about at TCG also is, you know, it's something that Howard Sherman talks a lot about with his column. He's very much on the case of colleges and educational productions not honoring the rights, the wishes of playwrights.
Right.
Whether it's about casting or just about cutting their work or censoring their work. I do think there needs to be an education that's should be part of theater education to talk about what theater is about and what it's supposed to represent and about playwrights' rights.
Allison, since you were just in school and you studied acting, like how did they approach it at Pace?
Well, it's interesting because when I think about this, so many of the roles that you play in college inform the types of roles that you're interested in playing when you leave school and you enter the professional world. So you do have to be a little wary of like, oh, I've been playing a lot of characters that are in their 50s, or like, oh, I'm playing mothers. You really have to hone in on and be careful of the scenes that you're choosing for class or even the student-directed plays that you participate in, so that you're kind of cultivating this, your own, well, your resume of what you're going out into the world with. And if you're playing characters that you're not going to be cast as in the professional world, like, you have to, it's something you have to think about. And I know in my experience at Pace University, we did a lot of student-directed plays, and the student directors would cast them, and we did a lot of scene work in class where we would choose our own material. So that was definitely something you'd think about. It's like, what are you actually going to be cast as?
Well, I mean, it's interesting because I've often heard from people that college, one of the great things about college is it's a time when you get to play parts you're never going to get to play. Like, you get to play the old ladies. You maybe get to play them, you know, 50 years from now, but you get to be stretched. I mean, Brandon Dearden, I spoke to recently in Illinois, he was talking, he did roles, as he says, that he had no business doing in college. And that's one of the joys. And so that's partly how you learn, by failing and playing, you know, Shakespeare when you're too young for it, or too old to play Romeo or whatever, or too young to play Lear. I mean, Brandon said he's played Othello twice and one time in college, which is like, I didn't know what the heck he was doing. He's played it again. He's heard that you need to play it three times and he feels like now he can finally do it. But
isn't there a difference though between, I mean, and I did not study theater in school. And so isn't there a difference between like playing these roles you would never get to otherwise play in a classroom versus doing a production of it? I mean, do they discourage casting against race slash type in university productions in your experience, Allison?
I mean, I would say the classroom was definitely a place where you can bend the rules a little bit and, mm-hmm. and play things that you're not necessarily fit for. But having gone to theater school in New York City, we had a pretty diverse class of actors.
Right.
I know one of my years we'd done Our Lady of 121st Street. So I mean that they chose productions where they would highlight all different races, and sometimes we had shows that were just all males, and
yeah.
So I don't even know what you asked.
No, it's interesting. I mean, especially in New York, you have the diversity, race diversity, ethnic diversity is not an issue. Age diversity is. I mean, it sounds frivolous, but one of my favorite productions of Company I ever saw was at UCLA. And just the woman, the girl who sang Ladies Who Lunch was great. She's one of the best Joannes I've ever seen, and she's probably 20, right? I heard about a production in Illinois of August Osage County with like a student production. I would love to see that. I mean, it's fun to watch. I mean,
yeah,
I'm making light of it, but it's actually interesting to watch young actors, their perspective on the material. It's sort of moving.
I guess it's not as big of a problem in New York when there's already a big, right. a large student body to choose
yeah,
from.
I would say
really do an all-white, you know, August Wilson.
Correct. Yeah, I think we were pretty lucky in having such a diverse school.
Right.
Oh, and I wanted to add one quick update on that situation, though. The Dramatists Guild has released a statement in support of Lloyd and Katori, saying that, you know, licensing agreements dictate you cannot change the content of the play, and to ignore the fact that race is an integral part of a play is disingenuous on the part.
Disingenuous, yeah.
Disingenuous on the part of the producers.
Right, and sometimes it's sincere naivete, but it's hopefully this will be a teaching moment and educational for people. I think they also cited the Motherfucker with a Hat production. Was it?
Theater yeah. Works in Connecticut.
That's right, that Theater Works. Yeah. I almost got that wrong.
They said Hartford Stage in the statement, but they had to amend that because I
remember
gonna
say Hartford
that
Stage is not the wrong. That's the wrong theater. I would like to say this last we'll say about it. We'll probably be talking about something like this again sometime soon, unfortunately. Let's briefly touch on the recent extravaganza that TCG threw. First there was the Fall Forum, which was a sort of like a mini conference. And Allison, you saw mm-hmm. all of that. We have a piece by you that's going to go up online probably next week. Give us your, you know, thumbnail version of
what
it was about.
So it was a very busy week last week. At TCG, the Fall Forum took place November 7th through the 9th, and it kicked off with a party at the Public Theater and went all weekend and then turned into the gala on Monday night. Hmm. So the forum this year was called Strategy Forward, and it was all about how to plan. So a lot of the breakout sessions were about a lean startup strategies, strategic planning, scenario planning for 10 plus years down the line for theaters. And strategy is such a huge umbrella term.
Yeah,
and for a lot of theaters, it means a lot of different things. And for some, it was expanding their audiences. For some, it was raising money. And others, it was transferring into a new space or leadership. So there was a lot of things that fall under strategy.
Right.
One of the highlights was the speaker on Saturday, Kion Krippendorf is his name. And
wow.
He just had a really inspiring speech. And he works with huge corporations like Microsoft and Johnson & Johnson and go in and consult with them to figure out what their plan is. And his idea is all based on these 36 stratagems from ancient China. And he finds these methods and these stories and ties them into what organizations can be doing to better strategize. So some of the takeaways from that were finding the fourth option. It was a recurring theme throughout the weekend of looking at not what the easiest way to get through a goal would be, but to find what your competitor or another theater would maybe not think of. And to give that choice time to figure out how to implement it into your theater. And the other was forcing a two-front battle. Those were the two takeaways from his speech. And He was very motivating. And then Gus Schulenburg, he followed up with a presentation on what strategy means for theaters, which was very helpful and I think helped tie in the whole purpose of the weekend, which was how they could take these big, huge ideas and help the nonprofit theater world. So he was helpful in compiling a whole list of all these studies that have been done on what strategy means and going through the main three different types of strategies, and what that looks like for different theaters. So there's breakout sessions with, one of them was the Lantern Theater Company in Philadelphia, who just went through a strategy, and they came out of a pretty tough place after the 2008 financial crisis. Another theater that I listened to in the breakout session was the Hadaloo Theater in Memphis, Tennessee.
Right.
And their strategy after moving into a new space is getting big corporations like Nike and a few others in Memphis to get funding. But what was interesting with them was they're going about it in a backwards kind of way. So instead of asking Nike and all these people to financially support their new institution, they're targeting the employees themselves and saying, hey, here's a BOGO ticket, like buy one, get one free, or here's 50% off, or we'll host your Christmas party. And then after tallying up all this data of who's coming to see their shows, they then write to Nike and say, hey, like 75% of your employees are enjoying our theater. You should come support. And so it's just different ways of thinking about fundraising.
When you say that was backwards, that was intentional, but it was a sort of through the side door kind of way to do it, right? Rather than going through the front door. Yeah, I like that.
And that's kind of encapsulated a lot of what was going on in the weekend. I was like, okay, like this is how normal people go. Like this is how you normally go about getting
how you normally think of doing it, right? Yeah.
But the whole weekend was about, okay, like how can you widen that question and figure out how else you can accomplish it? So widening the lens and kind of looking at, instead of asking, you know, like why don't we have younger audiences? Instead of asking that question to your board, ask where are the younger people spending their time and how could we target them better? Instead of, you know, like flipping the question to figure out a better way to get to these plans and these you know, 5 year out kind of ideas of how to bring them to your theater.
And wasn't Eva Van Hove one of the big keynote speakers? Like, did he say anything inspiring?
He was. He kicked off the party at the Public at Joe's Pub, which was really fun. One of his takeaways that was about strategy.
Because he ran a theater. He runs a theater company. He ran one, right?
He runs a theater. I'm going to not be able to pronounce it. Toneel Group Amsterdam.
Amsterdam, yeah.
And he splits his time between New York and I don't know if it would be Amsterdam.
Amsterdam, yeah.
And he...
Somewhere in Europe.
He seems to go to a lot of different places in Europe. So he just kind of talked about his own strategy of managing a company and he outsources a lot of his daily duties. He says, you know, like his strategy is to have a big team behind him.
It's to delegate.
Nice.
Good leadership quality, yes.
It was nice because he spoke a bit about A View from the Bridge, and then right after the little kickoff party, a lot of the conference goers and out of town theater people went to go see A View from the Bridge. So
wow.
It was nice.
I just learned a new term for BOGO. I've never heard that before. That's a great...
Buy one, get one. That is,
where, do you not go shopping, Rob?
I've never heard that term before.
God, Payless has been using that for years. Yes.
Okay. I didn't know that. I guess I don't do the shopping. I do online shopping and really, really quickly. And then the gala was a really fun night, I will say. We honored Brian Dennehy with a sort of – I don't think it was called officially a lifetime achievement. I think he sort of thought of it that way, and it really is a lifetime achievement.
Well, Nathan Lane came up and did a speech about Brian, and so did Bob Falls.
And the Goodman.
And they all did The Iceman Cometh together, and so – lovely speeches.
It was wonderful, and there were two wonderful musical performances, one by Jessie Mueller from Waitress. She can really sing, that girl.
And then
closing it in an inspiring way was The Lisps with the closing number of Futurity.
Yeah. Both of which you can actually listen to on Spotify. Waitress, Sarah Bareilles released some songs from Waitress on Spotify, so you can listen to that. And the list released Futurity on Spotify. So listen to both of those. Feel inspired.
You can also find, we put some Lisp songs up a couple years ago when they did it at ART. But you can also look for those, but or just go to Spotify.
Yeah.
Anyway, it was quite an evening. You know, I think I heard someone else say, I'll attribute it to someone else, that made him proud to work here. So.
And we made a lot of money, too.
Well, it was the gala. It's gala, not gala, right? Anyway, gala implies fundraising.
Yeah. Well, and thank you to all of our readers who texted in pledges to help support TCG and American Theater.
There were some nice, nice messages there. We will now go to our interview we did with Francine Reynolds about doing theater in Mississippi. And I think, is it their 50th anniversary there at New Stage doing, and they're going to do Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, which was something they opened their theater with. And if you do the math, we talked about this. That play was pretty new and pretty shocking for its time. So that was a pretty bold way to open the theater. And we'll talk to Francine now. All right, here with Francine Reynolds. You're the artistic director of New Stage Theater in
Jackson, Mississippi.
Jackson, Mississippi. And I think maybe the only TCG member in Mississippi. Is that right?
That's right.
I'm interested in the theater, but first tell me a little bit about the theater scene in Mississippi and in Jackson specifically.
Well, in Mississippi, there's a large community theater population, and
right.
the secondary schools have great theater departments, and
okay.
they go to the Southeastern Theater Conference every year.
Mm-hmm.
There's big high school drama festivals, big community theater festivals, but right now, New Stage Theater is the one professional theater in the state.
Okay. The one professional theater in the state. Wow.
I know there are some other entities that pay artists from time to time, but we are the year-round operating, fully staffed, paying the actors, paying everybody theater.
Wow. Wow. That's a big responsibility. Now, it's been,
yes.
you told me the 50-year anniversary is coming up.
We're in our 50th season right
50th
now.
50th season right now. Yeah. And, so it started out, I think, if I read correctly, in a little church. Is that correct?
It did. There were several people who had been involved in the Little Theater of Jackson, in the community theater in the town, and they decided they wanted to do something different.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted to do a different type of play, and they wanted to begin the path towards a professional theater.
Mm-hmm.
And they wanted to open the doors to everybody. They wanted to desegregate the audience
mm-hmm.
and desegregate the stage and turn it into something that wasn't a membership organization. Because
oh, okay.
Little Theater was membership-based. You know, everything was driven by what the members thought.
Okay. So, like, they were not just subscribers. It was like a membership organization.
Exactly.
Right? Okay.
Exactly.
Like a private club almost, yeah?
Yeah. And I think they did good things. I think there was nothing wrong with what they were doing at that time, because if you put it in the context of the time – that's what was going on in the community.
Right, right.
But these, I think, brave people decided they wanted to do something different, and so they found a building, which was an old church, and they turned it into a theater. They chartered in 1965, and their first show was in 1966. So it was the 1965-66 season, much as we're in the 2016 season. And they opened with Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, which was amazing to do that in Jackson, Mississippi in 1966.
Right, because that was that 63-64 that
right.
premiered?
Right, exactly.
That's a pretty new play.
A play that was supposed to have been given the Pulitzer, and they wouldn't give it to
you. Because of the language.
Right.
Right. So, yeah, it was that's a radical choice. And now you're revisiting in this coming season.
We are.
Is that right?
Almost 50 years to the date. We're going to do it in January. And it the theater opened in January of 1966. So we're doing it in January and February.
So that sort of caps a legacy there. Now, you told me last night it's an exciting season, but you told me last night that you were – and I didn't realize this – you were the first theater outside – New York to do All the Way.
That's correct, yes.
And you wrangled the rights.
Yes.
You got on the phone and were persistent, right?
Right, right.
Yeah.
And I think the playwright and Bill Rausch, they discussed it. I believe this is what I was told. And they said that it was appropriate for us to be able to do the show
right.
because of the activities that happened in Mississippi in 1964. And we wanted to do it 50 years from the date of the signing of the Civil Rights Act.
And you did.
Yeah, and the Freedom Democratic Party. So.
Yeah, no, it's not that it escaped my attention. There's a lot of, it's interesting because it's a play about the nation. It's got a lot of places, like Texas has a big claim on the play because of where LBJ is from. But
right.
I remember, you probably know the play, there's a water project in Arizona that helps get by a vote. And it's like, I know that from my state, you know, and I think it's an Indiana Republican senator that they give some credit to because he was one of the ones who, so you know,
right? It's a lot of
play for the whole nation, yeah, right?
But I think it's just because of Freedom Summer
yeah,
and
totally.
Bob Moses and you know the group of people who were active in 1964 in Mississippi, and so we were very proud to be able to do the show, and we partnered with the Mississippi Department of Archives and History, and Reverend Ed King, who's a character in the play,
right? You mentioned
was yeah. instrumental in, you know, provoking and promoting the show and provoking us to do the show, and he was a big factor, I believe, in us getting the rights. Also,
now, did you? I imagine there were a lot of events planned around it, talkbacks, that kind of thing, seminars, that kind of.
Oh yeah, yeah, amazing yeah. panel discussions. We had four of them, and we had like a former governor, Governor William Winter was on our panel.
Yeah.
Ed King was on a panel, of course, and some activists from the time,
right,
on panels, and a scholar because we also got funding from the Mississippi Humanities Council to present these panels, and they were packed. We did them in different places throughout the city. We did them near Jackson State University campus in a coffee house that was just packed. We did it at the old Capitol Museum,
right,
packed, and we did two at the theater also.
So. Now, I think you were telling me about another play that you got the rights to pretty early. Am I right about that or no? You do a lot of plays that we've seen in New York,
yes,
but not necessarily right away.
Well, yes. We try to do this season is the type of season where we do a what I call an American classic every year. And that would have been All the Way. That was a classic story. So
sure.
That was our classic. The year before we did The Grapes of Wrath as
okay.
our classic.
Right,
this
right.
year, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf?
Sure.
So we do a classic. We try to do a Southern theme play.
That'd be Crimes of the Heart this
year. Right,
time,
that's right.
Right.
Yeah, right. Crimes of the Heart. We definitely try to do a new play. We try to do, I hate to say an African-American theme play, but a play by a black playwright, one or two a season. We try to do a comedy. So those are the types of things we do. So a new play, we've done Other Desert Cities soon after it was on Broadway. The play I think you're referring to is I Really Fought Hard to get the rights to Lombardi.
Oh, that's right. You mentioned that.
Right.
Yeah,
because,
yeah.
I'm a huge Green Bay Packer fan. That's one reason. So I followed it around. But, because Brett Favre's from Mississippi, you know, a huge Green Bay
sure.
Packer and that type of thing. And I was interested in the show and I enjoyed the show and I knew I had people who could play the parts.
Right.
So,
right.
And there's been some others that I've lobbied for pretty early on. A few that I haven't been successful in getting right away. But some plays that were still in manuscript form we've done, like G's Bend, that came out of Alabama.
Who's the playwright?
Elizabeth Gregory Wilder
okay.
is the playwright.
I've heard of that.
Yeah. Southern Writers. I think it's the Southern Writers Project. It's at Alabama Shakespeare Festival. I think it, I believe it came out of there. I know she's done some things there.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Now, I know, was Eudora Welty was involved in the founding or she was around at the founding or?
She was involved with the Jackson Little Theater, as a matter of fact.
Okay,
and
I gotcha.
she loved theater.
Yeah.
And she was so excited when her, novel The Pond of Heart was turned into a play and it played on Broadway. She loved theater and she eventually was on the board of New Stage Theater and really supported the theater until the day that she was incapable of coming to the theater.
Right,
when I was young, I was involved with the theater myself for a few years as education director and then I left for a number of years. But when I was education director, I was also acting and I was thrilled when she came to shows, if I was in the show and she talked to me after at the cast party, that type of thing, because Eudora Welch is a huge celebrity for us.
Yeah, totally.
But yeah, she was actively involved on the board.
Right, right. Now, there's a new play series named after her.
The Eudora Welty New Play Series.
You do that every year?
Yes, in different forms. Okay. In some forms, it's people, playwrights can submit their plays, mm-hmm. and we give a monetary award right. to three plays. One playwright receives $1,000, one playwright receives $250, and one playwright receives $150. And sometimes those amounts change a little, and we do staged readings of those plays.
Right. Okay. So there's, and you know, there's local writers. I know there's a Gary Grubbs who's a Mississippian who's
right, an actor.
There.
It's taken different forms in the past. Sometimes the Eudora Welty New Play Series has been mounting a new play and not readings of a play, not selected that way. But the artistic director at the time, and this was when Eudora was still alive, with Eudora's blessing is maybe not the right word, but Eudora would read the plays also, and would be chosen to, like Full Moon, Reynolds Price Full Moon was done in the Eudora Welty New Play Series at one time. So those types of things too. And some of you, there was an opera developed around the Ponder Heart also, and that received, and that's when the Eudora Welty New Play Series actually started, when that opera was presented. That was a big project, and it was written by Alice Parker, who composed it.
Now, you've been the artistic director for how long?
I was interim artistic director for a year, and then I was named artistic director in 2007.
Okay, so for a while. Now, mm-hmm. I wonder if you could talk about what you've seen change. I guess the question I want to ask is, what's the community like? What's the art support on the state level and the city level look like for Mississippi?
Well, for us, it has been tremendous. We've had tremendous growth. Our season ticket buyers have increased every year, except one since I've been there. One, we had 75 less than we had before.
Right.
This year we have 300 more subscribers, I think, than we did last year. I can't remember all the numbers, but we just keep increasing our ticket sales and increasing our programming. We tour, when I came on, we were touring to maybe 7,000 students throughout the state. We toured last year to 24,000 students throughout the state with our arts and education tours.
Wow.
Yeah, into 70 schools, that type of thing. So we just keep expanding. We've found a lot of support for what we do.
And now is that not the patrons and stuff, but what about the state support, or is it just?
We also the Arts Commission gets money from the National Endowment for the Arts and from other things, and we do receive grant money from the Mississippi Arts Commission, and we do have certain corporations and foundations that fund us also. Right. So I would say that for us, the support is good. We can always do look for more funding and more support. We're actually in a fundraising campaign right now around the 50th anniversary.
So you would say it's a theater-friendly state, theater-friendly town for the most part? Or you still have some challenges?
We still have some challenges.
Yeah.
I think it's our supporters are active and avid supporters.
Yeah.
And they will tell me what they think of things. You know, it's a conservative audience.
Right.
So our risk ratio is maybe not what you would find in other areas of the country.
Sure.
So it's a big deal when we do a show like Other Desert Cities and it has language in it.
Yeah,
we're doing Red this year. We're a little bit behind on that. And I've wanted to do Red since it first came out.
Right.
But I've developed a partnership with the Mississippi Arts Museum to do the show. They have an exhibit, and they'll have a Rothko. And so we're doing some programming around that. But that's challenging because Red has language in it.
Right, right.
You know, and so we just have to prepare our audience for that. And there's certain times when I've gotten some letters for some of the work that we do, but I feel like we, as a regional theater, must and should do that work.
Yeah. You know, speaking of languages, when we mentioned Virginia Woolf, I think Albie has gone back and salted it up a little bit. So I think some of the original phrases where they weren't saying the F word, but now that
right,
I think
that's in the script. That's in the acting script. Yeah,
the acting script now. Yeah. I don't. But it was something else. It was a euphemism, I think, back in the '60s.
I'll have to research that.
But I'm not sure. Anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, because it just seemed absurd after all this time to still be saying freaking, or what, I don't even remember what it was.
Well, and it's we're in conservative, you would say Bible Belt region of the country. And so that is always a challenge. It's always going to be a challenge. We've really diversified our programming and audience the last 10 years, and that's been very supported by our board of trustees, very supported by the community.
Does that segment of the population, you program specifically for them, like shows that are about their world or authors who
if you look at our season this year, because it's a 50th anniversary season, if we weren't doing Red, it would have had, you know, tie-ins with the past or tie-ins with Mississippi throughout the entire season.
Sure.
Red was an opportunity because of the partnership with the Arts Museum, but we just closed A Time to Kill, on Mississippi novelist's work. We're doing we're doing The Robber Bridegroom based on the novella by Eudora Welty.
Okay, sure.
So I do try to have a Southern, like, the Beth Henley. We just recently remounted the Miss Firecracker contest. I want to do the Jacksonian in the future.
I was going to ask about that, because talk about a play that's challenging.
Right. We may do that in our smaller space. I'm not sure. But because it seems like it needs to be in our smaller space, because of the play itself, I think the intimacy would be great for that play. We always try to do something that's, you know, based on a Mississippi writer or a Southern writer, that type of thing. And you may be asking about the African American audience.
Sure.
We do shows that have been really responded to quite well. Some musicals, some plays, Mahalia Jackson, a gospel musical was a show that I had looked at and I didn't think it would be, you know, as successful as it was. So I was really happy about that. Yeah. So.
The last thing I wanted to ask about was just about the talent pool there. You mentioned that you had the right actors for Lombardi.
Right.
And All the Way is a huge cast.
Right.
Are there lots of actors locally, or you have to cast out
I come here, or New York, to do casting every year, twice a year, or three times a year. It just depends on the schedule. I've been to Atlanta. I've been to New Orleans. We go to the combined auditions every year, different combined auditions. And then, through submissions, that type of thing. So we cast from all over.
Right.
We do have a great pool of talented actors who make their career in the area, who are members of the union.
Right.
And then we have a great pool of talented people who may have other jobs also, which is challenging for rehearsal schedule.
Sure.
I will say that some, you know, if I have a large cast show like A Time to Kill that we just did, which I was committed to having as many people from the community, from Mississippi in the show as possible.
Right.
So a lot of that rehearsal had to happen on the weekends and nights, Tuesday through Sunday instead of during the day, which is hard sometimes on the staff. Because even when you rehearse at night, you're still working all day anyway. I feel like we have a very talented pool of people. We have a very talented pool of musicians, you know. And like
imagine.
We did It Ain't Nothing But the Blues last year. And we've got wonderful blues musicians and singers and, you know, actors and actresses. But I do bring in people from here, from New York, or from other regions of the country.
Yeah, it's not just actors, but all the design talent, talent.
The designers I pull from the colleges and universities in the state.
I just
had a brilliant designer for A Time to Kill. It was a wonderful design, who is a professor at University of Mississippi in Oxford, Mississippi. So we pull guest directors from different areas also, but for the designers and that type of thing, I do try to stick within the state and use those professionals. Sometimes we've had people other than Mississippians.
The outsiders.
Yeah.
I don't want to keep you too long here. I know you've got to get going. I know you just here. We're here for the TCG board meeting in the gala and the forum. I don't know if there's anything about that struck you in particular that, you feel like.
There's always lots to take home. I think the equity work that TCG G does and is doing is really important, and it always informs me, and it's something that's always on my mind in where I live and with what we're doing. And so I always try to take that back with me, but also a lot of skills building, a lot of things I learn every time I come to a fall forum or a conference that I may not go back and announce, hey, this is what I learned, but I use it in different ways.
Yeah, sure.
And it's real important for where we are. I want to bring other people too. I want other members of my staff and board of our staff and board to come to some of these things, because it's just, it's affirming for what we're doing. Mm-hmm. When I take back, hey, we're doing some of the same things that I hear about,
right,
you know,
right.
And it's good to talk about what we're doing to other people, because I think we're in a region that's often forgotten. It just is.
That's true.
And we're in a state that, as everybody knows, doesn't have a lot of money, but it also is a state that giving is high. You know, maybe not for the arts as much as it could be,
right,
but it's a charitable state.
Individual giving.
Yes,
yeah,
individual
yeah.
giving.
Wow.
Is very high in right. Mississippi for charities and not-for-profits and things like that. Like I said, not as much for the arts, but so I've learned a lot. The fall forum about governance, just a whole lot that I have to process and take notes on from my notes to figure out what I learned, because I learned so much. My mind is like, you know, full of everything that I have to distill.
Yeah, we definitely feel that even here at the magazine, we feel after going to a conference, we've got to debrief.
Yeah.
Got so much written down and ideas, but it's good. It's good to have too many ideas, right?
Yeah.
Francine, I thank you for taking the time.
Thank you for having me.
Stop by anytime.
All right.
Okay. And we're back. Let's do some recommendations and chatter about stuff that we've seen or are thinking about and want to tell you about. Allison, why don't you start off?
All right. So last night I saw the new musical Gigantic by the Vineyard Theater, and it was a production at Theater Row. And it was by Randy Blair, Tim Drucker, Matthew Roy Berger. And Gigantic is about a group of teenagers that go to a weight loss camp in southern Pennsylvania, and kind of about this, you know, camp experience they have. I just kept thinking back to that movie with Ben Stiller. Do they remember this? Called Heavyweights?
No.
And Ben Stiller was the camp counselor, like kind of leading all the group of kids to lose weight. So it was very funny. I mean, it was, some parts of it were a little ridiculous and crazy. But it was just a fun, entertaining new musical.
So what was the casting like? Was it a lot of really big people?
It was. I mean, it was.
I mean, I feel like it's really hard to keep off that weight when you're in the show 8 times a week and having
That's
to...
What I
yeah,
thought
like, are they, like, eating carbs?
There was tons of dancing in it. And I don't know. I mean, I thought of that, too, when last night as I was watching it. Like, what was the breakdown like for this? Or, mm-hmm. you know, like... overweight
yes,
actors
question.
Need it. I don't
right,
know, but
right.
it,
yeah, and like you have to be able to eat a lot in between shows to keep the weight up,
right? I mean, there was a lot of physical movement going on in this musical, a lot of dancing. So
I've often thought about with actors who are known for playing like the sort of the chubby or roly-poly best friend, like that's part of their brand, you know,
right.
and then they want to get healthy. I mean, Chris Pratt lost so much weight after, I mean, he was known for sort of being a little bit baggy, and now he's like Mr. Action Hero.
And leading man, you know, Jurassic World would do that to you.
James Corden, I think, has dropped a few pounds. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's all like healthy. And anyway, I wonder if that show goes places, maybe that would be something we'll talk
maybe.
About. That show's going to be big, I hear. No.
It's going to be gigantic.
It's going to be huge. Deep, what you got for recommendations this week?
Sure. I have a recommendation/call of action because I've started getting into this television show on the CW called My Crazy Ex... Actually, no.
Just called Crazy Ex-Girlfriend.
Called Crazy Ex-Girlfriend.
Mm, right.
And I don't remember who created it, but it's structured like a musical. It's like what we wanted Smash to be, but it just failed so miserably. It's about this woman who's a Harvard graduate lawyer, and she's kind of going through a nervous breakdown, and then she spots her high school ex-boyfriend and moves to California, not for him, she claims, but kind of for him, slash to get a new lease on life. And now she's trying to, you know, break up him and his girlfriend and trying to get closer to him. And she's also really insane and everyone points it out, but she doesn't believe that about herself. And then she also has some personal issues. And did I mention it's a comedy?
and it's a musical.
Musical. Yeah. And Santino Fontana plays like the plan B option. And he does some singing too. Like in the fourth episode, he has this amazing Fred Astaire, black and white Fred Astaire number called Settle for Me. And
I've heard about the show, yes. And I so want to see it. I have to sell all ideas. Don't get them past my wife, and she's not sold on the idea of a musical drama. It's like a 1 hour comedy.
It's a 1 hour comedy. There's usually two
it's
songs.
Called Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. That's a hard sell.
Yeah. Well, it's one of those shows I think is being, the ratings are so low because the title is terrible.
Right, right. I mean, I've heard back and forth about how the title actually is brilliant once you watch the show, but. Yeah. But
because she's actually
it's Rachel
crazy.
Something Rachel
Bloom
Rachel Bloom yeah
I think she's one of the producers and I think she co-created it.
She's a star too,
yeah,
right?
And she's a star, and like every single musical number, it's like a pastiche of sorts of other contemporary music. Like the first song in the show is this big Broadway, you know, Welcome to West Covina, California. It's an amazing place. It's only 3 hours from the beach, 4 in traffic. And then the next song is like this R&B, like the sexy getting ready song, like inspired by all those, you know, songs about ladies making themselves pretty for men. So it's and in the last episode, she raps about being really good at with parents. So it's just.
I got to check that out. And the call to action is so that it will stay on, right?
Yeah, so people should watch it.
Yeah.
Smash survived because a lot of theater people were watching it. So you guys should watch this too.
Did it really survive though? Now it's on the CW. Okay. Mm-hmm. I'll take a look for that. I've got to schedule it. An hour of comedy though. That's a really weird form.
Yeah, Monday comedy. It's not like you're doing anything on Mondays. It's not like any of us are doing anything on Mondays.
But wait, do you still watch it when it's on? Do you actually watch shows when they're on?
No.
Exactly. So like Monday, what does that mean? I'll watch it whenever I'll just.
I know, it's for theater people. They're not doing anything on Mondays.
Okay. I gotcha. I look forward to that. Just really briefly, I don't think it's running much longer, but I will just say that I sort of had that beat covering toddler theater because I've had some toddlers. And
are they still toddlers?
Well, I mean, the three-year-old is technically still a toddler. Okay. Anyway, I've seen a lot of it. I've liked some of it. I thought it's just like kind of BS. I could do the same thing at home, right? You know? But one of the best shows I'd say it's one of my favorite shows in this genre, and it's like just a great show. It was called White, and it was at New Victory 4 years ago, and my now six-year-old saw it when he was two, loved it. He tells me he doesn't remember it, but he was two. I just took my three-year-old yesterday. He loved it. It's Andy Manley and Catherine Wheel's company created it. It's just beautifully designed. It plays with kids' expectations in a really fun way, and way that it just slightly tricks them. And just to hear their delight at the surprise. It's basically two guys who live in a world that's everything's white. And you know, the sort of racial subtext is definitely there, but it's not stressed. It's just everything is white. They're cleaning and they get eggs every day, and they raise these little eggs, little children every day from the sky. And then all of a sudden, little swatches of color appear, and they try to banish it into the bin, but everything kept, they find a red egg and one of them wants to keep it. Anyway, it's so sweet and the kids love it. I can't emphasize enough. If it comes to your town, rush to see it. It's so good. If you've got a kid, it's 2 to 5 is what the age that it's intended for. I think Oliver went when he was just barely two. Anyway, highly recommend that. And then just briefly, I want to say, I wish I'd seen these plays earlier so someone could write a piece about this, but I was really struck by two performances in two totally separate plays, two family plays, Here, H-I-R, and The Humans. Daniel Oreskes plays a stroke-addled patriarch in here, and he's amazing. You know, he's on stage throughout the entire show, and he has lines, but he's basically out of it and is spoken of as if he's not there. He kind of plays a pivotal role in sort of the way the play turns out, but he's so good at this, the curtain call is like striking because like his face suddenly snaps into, you know, to life again, and his it's just a striking performance, and it's easy to underestimate. And then Lauren Klein in The Humans plays Momo, the grandmother, who's apparently, they don't use the word Alzheimer's, I don't think, but she's basically,
I think they use the word dementia, don't they?
Well, dementia is a symptom of Alzheimer's, yeah. Right? So she's wheeled in, and she's on stage almost all the way throughout. And I get a little emotional just thinking about the performance because it was so well done. It seems like so easy, just like, oh, you're just out of it. But like, I can't imagine that's an easy role to play, not least because it's sort of anticipating a place that one might go. And just to be in that space and put that on stage, both of those performers, I think, like, deserve special commendation. And also, you know, for the playwrights, it may be easy to write like this person's just out of it, but then to actually, you know, stage
perform
that,
it, yeah,
and cast it. I you know, The Humans in particular has a scene. It's not a spoiler to say there's a sort of a moment of crisis with the grandmother, which just I get emotional just talking about it. That play is going to be on Broadway, and I think both of them deserve a special commendation. I hope Lauren Klein stays with that production. That's not a very happy way to end the podcast, but look for these stroke and dementia adult performances in the future.
I don't even think it's possible to cast those to type.
Also crossed my mind when we talk about neurodiversity with the push for Curious Incident and other kinds of casting where disability is an issue. I mean, it may be worth a conversation, but it seems like it's an acting challenge. And I would love to know more about the actor's process and the directing process for those parts.
Yeah, me too. Yeah.
So maybe a future piece about that, folks, huh? We're having an editorial meeting here.
Yeah, you're just talking about it, Rob. Might as well just do it.
Let's just do it. All right. I think here's only up to the end of through this weekend. But
no, it's here's up until December 20th. It just got extended again.
Interesting. All right. Well,
yeah, you got time.
Let's think about it, folks. All right. On that happy note, come onto iTunes or your favorite podcast deliverer of choice and rate us, review us, comment, call in if there are any corrections, and keep listening. Thanks for tuning in.